which each home has its own power generator that obtains this energy in such a way that no fuel has to be added. Imagine every vehicle being able to run without ever stopping for fuel. Imagine each appliance having its own power source that never has to be recharged. That is the world of the future. Join with us now as we track our progress towards such a world.
Welcome to Free Energy Now. I'm your host, Sterling Allen. You can join us online at freeenergynow.net, where you can see a past lineup of speakers, see who we have coming down the pike, and download past shows. Tonight, we have on the show Tim Ventura. He's a friend of mine, associate for quite some time in renewable energy, free energy, and anti-gravity. He is the webmaster of AmericanAntiGravity.com, owner of that site. Very interesting technologies that he's covered over the years. I'm kind of thinking to myself why it's taken me so long to have him on. Very interesting, gentlemen. Today is February 2nd, 2009. Not only has he covered the subject of anti-gravity, he has built anti-gravity devices, things called lifters. The best one he built, he says, was about 4 feet long, actually triangular shape, and he got that thing 20 feet up in the air using ionic forces. So imagine this thing just floating in the air. It doesn't have any propulsion in terms of, like, propellant that we typically think of, just using electromagnetic types of forces. So glad to have you on, Tim. Thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me on, Sterling. And I guess I should reciprocate by saying that I've been a big fan of the work that you've been doing at PES, Wiki, and Pure Energy Systems for several years now. It really is an amazing clearinghouse for just information on all sorts of emerging energy and free energy devices and researchers. So that's definitely a great place where I found a ton of information really across the entire scope of alternative and emerging science.
Thanks, Tim. Well, you know, this the kinds of things that you cover over there at American Anti-Gravity are just really quite amazing. And I've been glad to see that you've kind of rolled up your sleeves again. You kind of took a hiatus for a little while. You know, life's been tough for a lot of us, and you've had some challenges, and you're getting back into the game. I'm really glad to see you kicking around and hearing things from you, and look forward to what you might be posting on your site as you get things up and running. And I might add that if people want to access some of the former material there that it's had to be removed with different ways that the site's being built, you can always go to archive.org and pull up those old links if they're broken now. But looking forward to what you're going to be putting up there in the future. Tell us about the lifters. What is a lifter?
Well, lifter technology, basically, I guess most innovators with an interest in anti-gravity would know it as Biefield-Brown effect. And, of course, there's a giant debate as to whether or not the Biefield-Brown effect is real or if this technology is actually something called ion wind. Now, ion wind is actually pretty common. The idea is that if you put a high voltage on a wire, it will excite air molecules to carry electrons literally across an air gap to a piece of foil that's electrically grounded. So it's like anything else. You put a bunch of water into a hose, turn up the pressure, that water wants to go somewhere, except in this case it has to go to ground. So it basically creates a cloud, and that cloud is attracted to foil underneath it. And in a sense, you're moving air, just like a jet engine or anything else, except that it does so with zero moving parts. And I think that's the attraction of ion wind devices, which have really been around since the 1950s. Alexander De Seversky, built the first one. It was called the flying bedspring. I think that was probably the first that most people had heard about. I believe he had that device up maybe around 12 feet in the air, and he did smoke tests just to show that it was moving air. In that particular case, if you can imagine something that looks a little bit like a bedspring, it's got thin wires, a mesh of thin wires over the top, and then maybe around 2 or 3 inches below that, it's got thicker wires or tubes. And basically, again, a high voltage on those thin wires excites air, which travels down to the tubes, and since you have air moving down, it creates a slight vacuum, you've got lift, just like a helicopter or an aircraft wing. Now, the ion wind part of that is interesting because it doesn't have moving parts, but it's not remarkable, and it does require air in order to operate, so it's not highly useful for space propulsion. Now, there was another fellow named Thomas Townsend Brown, and he did most of his work in the 1960s and 1970s, and he was convinced that instead of simply moving air, having a small element that was charged with a high voltage next to a large element that was acting as a ground or having a negative voltage, essentially, would create forward motion in one direction. And he believed that it did it, in a sense, by kind of clawing its way through the fabric of space-time, literally just kind of moving time-space around it. And we would look at something like that today and say that fits the bill for what we call reactionless propulsion or even anti-gravity. So T.T. Brown really was, I think, one of the fathers of anti-gravity, in a sense, one of the fathers of reactionless propulsion. But there has been tremendous debate about whether or not the device works. And every time one side gets an answer, someone else on the other side seems to come up with information that refutes it. NASA has done studies showing that lifters, for instance, don't work in a vacuum. Now, if that's the case, then ion wind is the only thing at play, and it's really not that interesting in terms of future space propulsion. However, there were also some other studies done, a couple of Army fellows, and they were some of the most recent and more credible, did a study showing that at a complete vacuum, it actually did produce thrust. Now, if that's the case, then T.T. Brown was right, and there is literally a reactionless component taking place. I think what's important about that is that, obviously, if we can find a device that can move forward without expending fuel, then it can literally propel itself forever, even if it's only a few grams of force, even if it's just a tiny little amount. If you can keep that force applied to it indefinitely, you can reach speeds that are tremendously faster than even the fastest rocket today is capable of, because it only has a limited amount of fuel that it can burn. So reactionless propulsion really is the holy grail if we're ever going to make it to another star system. And I suspect that there is more to what T.T. Brown saw than the established scientific community tends to think or has thought in the past, and we'll see more movement in this area in the near future.
Where do you think that energy is coming from?
Well, it's difficult to say, and the reason it's difficult is I think you get into this world of unified field theory physics, and this is what Einstein spent the last 30-something years of his life working on. It's certainly complicated, but the idea is that by twisting time and space, you're able to change a lot of, I guess, paradigms that we take for granted, right? Like the meaning of the word up and down. And, of course, if you can turn off gravity and move something up, and then turn gravity back on or just turn off this nullification field, you can always extract energy from it on its way down. So I think what you're driving at is gravity modification tied to free energy of some type? And I think that most people with an interest in and some research experience in this area definitely think there's an overlap. The question is just really how to exploit that. And I think that's an area that people have tried various paths to reach, but nobody really has the perfect approach yet at this point in time.
Now, I was doing some searching recently, and I keep coming across your name, your website. You're one of the first people to interview John Searle after his and he kind of went out of circulation for a while, and there was another one that I was looking at. Yeah, Mr. Rafael Morgado, the Mighty Itani, you were one of the first people to ever interview him, kind of brought him into recognition. I was looking on their site, and I think your interview is the first thing they mentioned in their list of past news items. That was like 5 or 6 years ago.
Well, thank you. I appreciate your mentioning those. It's been a while since I've thought about a lot of the interviews that I've done. you know, one of the things that I found was I got into this area because I was a techie. I was interested in the technology, you know, the kind of person who can't just be happy with what they read in popular science. I had to dig a little bit deeper. And what I found was the more I started publishing, the more I fell in love with interviewing. So in a sense, it kind of brought me full circle to being a people person, at least to some degree. And I'm sure you would agree with this wholeheartedly that this is one of those endeavors where you will meet some of the most interesting people in the entire world. Certainly the people that I've had the chance to talk with.
Absolutely.
Yeah, you know, those are experiences I wouldn't trade for anything.
Yeah, I have to compliment you. Just, you know, as you're talking this evening on the show, you're extremely articulate and enjoyable to listen to.
Oh, I appreciate you saying that. You know, my worry, though, is right now I'm actually working on the other side of things. I've been focused a lot on the website. And so, in a sense, like the URL is www.americanantigravity.com, but anyone visiting that tonight will only see a single page and essentially links to, you know, some of our sister sites, as well as Pure Energy Systems and other sites worth visiting. And part of the reason for that, and I'm sure this is a challenge that you've run up against as well, is there's so much wonderful information out there that no matter how great you build your framework on day one, you know, give it a year or two, and it will just be a maze on the back end, on the content management system. And with American Antigravity, it reached that point where I had so much information and I spent so much time trying to keep it organized. But what I found was most of the people visiting the website only visited a few pages, and they really just weren't getting access to most of the information that was there. And so one of the things that I've been working on lately is to try and find new ways to present the information. And certainly this is a challenge to anyone doing web design of any kind. You know, how to put the information out there so that people can find it and use it, you know, and give them fingertip access. And my hope there is that, you know, as I proceed, I'll be able to create something that's a little bit more cohesive this time, that'll hopefully give users a little bit more value for their time.
We're going to be going to break here in a minute or so. When we come back, one of the things I'd like to ask you is, of all the anti-gravity technologies that you saw as you were looking in the field and exploring different things, what was it that excited you the most, that you saw to be the most plausible, the most, you know, something that was really going to end up materializing? And then later in the next segment, I'd like to ask you about your thoughts about what's flying around that the people are seeing and calling UFOs and whatnot. Are they U.S. origin, or are they man-made origin? Are they coming from extraterrestrial sources, or a combination of both? So that's what's coming up on the show. We're talking to Tim Ventura.
I plugged the ScanGauge 2 into my car in 10 seconds and could read my gas mileage instantly. It helped me save on fuel by improving my driving habits. If my check engine light turns on, I can figure out why without paying a mechanic. This device has saved me money.
The ScanGauge also provides information about engine load, ignition timing, and on my vehicle, it tells me the transmission temperature.
The ScanGauge is manufactured right here in Mesa. Call us at 480-656-3842 or visit us online at ScanGauge.com. Again, that's 480-656-3842.
Will you be ready when gas prices go back up? Convert your vehicle to a hydrogen boost hybrid. Get 15 to 25% improved gas mileage guaranteed or your money back. And cleaner emissions. Hydrogen Boost has 8 years of experience in hydrogen injection and mileage enhancement and a money back satisfaction guarantee. Visit www.hydrogen-boost.com or call 518-480-4026. Hydrogen Boost, 518-480-4026 or visit hydrogen-boost.com.
Free energy, now!
Sterling Allen coming back at you. We're here in Utah. I'm talking to Tim Ventura up in Canada. He is, with American Anti-Gravity, one of my favorite sites over the years, a friend. We've met in person on, I think, a couple of occasions as he's come down to conferences in Salt Lake. We're talking about anti-gravity and some of its relations with new energy, but the question that we said we were going to ask when we came back from break was, Tim, what in all of your going around and looking at different things and talking with people on the phone and going to websites, what has gotten you over the years most excited in the field of anti-gravity?
Well, I think that the best way to answer that, if I can share a story and hopefully not ramble too much, but one of the impressions that I've had, I guess, is that with anti-gravity or, you could almost say artificial intelligence software, definitely free energy, you know, anything that's kind of on the edge there, with topics like that, I think that there are a few items that are really popular, you know, and they get a lot of press. And I think it's because they resonate with us on an emotional level. And like in the case of anti-gravity, maybe lifters could be one of those. You know, the Searle effect, definitely. There almost seem to be some kind of psychological Jungian archetypes where it fits with our brain for some reason or other. And therefore it becomes popular and stays popular. And what typically happens with ideas like that is people get interested in this area. At first they may see a couple of different things and they may start pursuing a certain path of research. And over time they start to meet peers. And those peers tend to lead them towards these publicly acknowledged things, right? Like the Searle effect, where it's well known. And so a lot of people will mention it. It shows up at conferences. And people will proceed to get into those areas, and a lot of them get disenchanted because, you know, quite obviously, if the Searle effect was at that point where it was changing the world, then we would see it all around us. So, you know, they reach that point where they see that this technology is held up, or they feel like maybe it won't work, or perhaps it won't work. I mean, for whatever the reason is, something is missing there. Something doesn't quite make it. And so they get burned out and say, this doesn't work, this is all garbage. But what I found is people who keep researching and people who keep an open mind, after that point, they become a little bit more skeptical. But in other ways, they also learn better ways to do their own research. And they start to stumble over ideas that really do matter, that really do have the potential to change the world. Now, in this case, I'm just using the Searle effect as an example because it's popular. I won't say whether or not it's workable. I honestly don't know. I think that there is something there, though. In that particular case, the inventor, John Searle, basically has what looks almost like a roller bearing. It's magnetized wheels, basically wheels within wheels, that rotate at a high speed and supposedly create all sorts of anti-gravity effects.
Does the evidence from history of records and documentation support that he actually had flying craft at one point?
Well, there are certainly photos, and various people have said controversial things about those photos. There are photos of the craft in the air, but there's also a controversial claim from an acquaintance of his from years ago, but that was suspended on a crane. So for every point, there's a counterpoint, and I think with technologies like this, it's something that makes them more interesting, but also a little bit more frustrating, because it's always difficult to know how real something actually is.
So of the technologies, which one would you say has the most promise?
The one that intrigued me the most, and I believe also has the largest promise, would be probably the Nazi Bell device. And I tend to roll that in with kind of a set of technologies. And part of that's just the way that I got involved with this story. But strangely enough, it started for me, I'd heard about the Nazi Bell, which Nick Cook has described in depth. And Igor Witkowski actually wrote a book about, I believe it was called Secret Weapons of the Wunderwaffe, but I might be mistaken. This device was apparently a secret World War II experiment by the Germans. They had an underground lab that was covered with tiles, and they would change out the matting and the tiles at the end of every shift. There was supposedly a high death rate with the workers and all sorts of strange lights in the area. But they also had a rig that looked almost like a helicopter test mount or a test mount for something that generated high amounts of propulsion. And this story, has been around since around 2000, I think, when Igor Witkowski broke it. And Nick Cook picked it up from there and published it in The Hunt for Zero Point, which was a book dealing with secret aerospace as well as some energy-related issues. And so this topic had been out there. But what surprised me was, in doing an interview on the Philadelphia experiment, I met a fellow named John Deering, who worked at a California defense subcontractor. And he had worked with Dr. James Corum, who any Tesla fanatic would know about in a heartbeat. Corum has been called the Tesla behind Tesla. And Deering and Corum both have described how the Philadelphia experiment could have used very similar technology to this Nazi bell, and in a strange sort of way, been an American version of the same thing that the Germans might have been testing. And the defining factor, the thing that brings these two technologies together, is actually Albert Einstein. And that was the part where Deering and Corum really contribute a lot. As it turns out, Corum was the fellow who translated Einstein's, I believe it was 1929, revision of the unified field theory, an as yet incomplete document that Einstein never did complete in his lifetime, but he made significant progress with it. The idea was connecting gravity with the other forces, and the paper was difficult for any scientist to understand, but doubly difficult for those who weren't trained in German, because a lot of German words in scientific literature don't translate perfectly, and so it takes someone like Corum to really go through and understand what's being said. Well, Corum believes that when Einstein fled Nazi Germany before the war, apparently he left behind copies of this theory, basically copies that his fellow scientists helped vet. They helped go through them and check equations, and they would give him feedback on his math. Well, Corum believed that they had used these to create the Nazi bell, and Einstein himself had worked on the Philadelphia experiment, and that would explain how you would have similar technologies on both sides of the war, despite the hostilities. It's an interesting idea. If it's true, because it's unified field theory work, it changes the entire paradigm. And I guess free energy would come out of that, gravity modification, potentially something like the Stargate even. It's difficult to say.
Where's this technology now?
That's a good question. One of the things that did interest me was apparently a company bought the old abandoned test site for the Nazi bell, and I've heard that they were going to basically plow under what remains of that test site and turn it into a lumber mill. What was interesting about that was this test site was in a pretty remote location in Poland, lots and lots of empty areas around it, and it was pretty remarkable for being unremarkable in terms of no one would really need to buy and build anything there. And yet this company did, which made a lot of people wonder if perhaps someone is still trying to protect these secrets.
So you think that maybe they did that to cover things over because they wanted to have an exclusive line on the knowledge and not allow others to come in and pick up some clues?
Well, potentially. If I remember correctly, my acquaintance Gary Stevenson, he talked about Heim theory. He was really excited about that when it was released. Heim theory, and again, I could be mistaken here, but there were a couple of scientists in Germany that had been working on this basically since the end of World War II. And this was, again, kind of another gravity modification similar to Einstein's unified field theory in some ways, a theory theory that basically Messerschmitt had been playing with until they were eventually bought by Daimler in the 90s. And I believe it was Daimler. So the executives went through all of these programs for this company they had just purchased, and they found this one and realized that in a minor way it actually violated the weapons treaty research from World War II. So they shut it down and made the theory public. Well, so here we have a World War II era theory that's been under development continuously for 50 years. No one had even paid attention to it. So these things are out there. They don't just disappear. They tend to pop back up at regular intervals and attract the crowd.
What I will really be curious to hear you talk about is, in all your goings around and looking at these things, how much of what we're seeing up in the skies that people are reporting and that the government's denying, how much of that is of our own origin, man-made, and how much of it is coming from extraterrestrial sources, and how much of the technology that was being developed back in this mid-last century, for example, Cyril technology, how much of that was absconded and is actually manifesting up in the skies nowadays?
But it's an interesting question, and I think it requires breaking down the types of vehicles that the government might be testing. A lot of things may appear to the untrained eye or to just a distant observer to behave like UFO when they actually aren't. For instance, a lot of unmanned aerial vehicles, especially newer ones, might be capable of acrobatics that an aircraft couldn't. That wouldn't mean that they were a UFO. It would just mean that they're a little bit smaller. They might be able to turn a little bit harder. They might be able to do some fancy maneuvering that we wouldn't expect to see, which could create some UFO reports. Another one that interested me was an interview with Paul Fizz, who was an aircraft designer for many years, and he is firmly convinced that Project Aurora is real, and that, in fact, we have aircraft. I'm sorry.
Yeah, go ahead.
I'm sorry. He believes that we have aircraft that go much more rapidly than that. Aurora was a Mach 6 spy plane that they were going to use to basically chase Russian subs. He believes that aircraft exist and might actually be able to hit Mach 25, which is escape velocity.
Mach 1, of course, is the speed of sound, and Mach 25 would be 25 times that.
And the fact that these things are being tested and the public tends to look the other way shows that there's a lot more out there than we're aware of.
Well, there's no doubt about that, and I'd be curious to explore more with you as to the extent of that, how much the government or black ops or whatever, kind of your take on that whole world of the shadow government and what they have and what they're hiding from us.
Yeah, well, I think it's interesting because it's so difficult to know anything for real in this area.
Right, we'll get into that after the break, bottom of the hour here.
Plugged the ScanGauge 2 into my car in 10 seconds and could read my gas mileage instantly. It helped me save on fuel by improving my driving habits. If my check engine light turns on, I can figure out why without paying a mechanic. This device has saved me money.
The ScanGauge also provides information about engine load, ignition timing, and on my vehicle, it tells me the transmission temperature.
The ScanGauge is manufactured right here in Mesa. Call us at 480-656-3842 or visit us online at ScanGauge.com. Again, that's 480-656-3842.
Gonna make a change in some lives today. We will work for not for profit. Grassroots movement spreads the word we say. We wanna make the world a little bit better. We just wanna help the world today.
Free energy now. Eagle Mountain, Utah.
We'll always take donations, that's for sure. Or some hardware volunteering. Give a little and you'll get back more. You know the future's looking brighter. We just
technology now.
We really want to change the world today. We just want to help the world.
866-536-1100.
That's our call-in number if you're listening live to the Free Energy Now show. I'm Sterling Allen. You can call us at 866-536-1100. We're on KFNX down in Phoenix, Arizona, and being rebroadcast over at bbsradio.com. Tonight we are talking to Tim Ventura, American Anti-Gravity, and a lot of interesting things. I wish we had about 4 hours. You know, Tim, I want to get your take on what's going on with, obviously, I mean, you listen to Coast to Coast, for example, and it's so clear that there are UFO sightings galore, and the U.S. government and other governments are still denying that there exists such a thing, that it's weather balloons or whatever, ridiculous explanations for what people are seeing. Clearly that they're covering something up. What's your take on all that stuff?
You know, I did a fair amount of work with military contacts, and I think, to me, the notion that's even scarier than the government knowing and covering things up is the idea that maybe the government doesn't know as much as we think they do. And maybe this cover-up, in a sense, maybe that's to some degree to make us feel more secure about things. But I guess from a pragmatic perspective, what I've wondered about UFOs, and I think a lot of people have wondered this also. You know, the UFO craze really hit American culture in the 50s. And I don't think it's coincidental that UFO sightings started after the detonation of the atomic bomb. You know, before the A-bomb, no one had really heard of UFOs. I mean, there are historical reports, right, like Ezekiel's wheel in the Bible, which may be a UFO sighting, or could possibly be the work of God. But when you look at the modern era of mechanical craft from unknown origin, that really started after the detonation of the bomb. And I always wondered if there is, some type of new physics out there, right? An unknown energies. The bomb would certainly tap into those. Maybe it was like ringing a bell in an interested or, extraterrestrial.
Well, talking about ringing a bell, I've always wondered if maybe the detonation of nuclear forces on the planet set off a cosmic SOS to other enlightened cultures out there in the universe that said, uh-oh, somebody's playing with some pretty dangerous stuff down there. Let's kind of go, let's just go babysit a little bit, make sure they don't get out of hand.
Sure. Well, you know, and there were a lot of reports that, in fact, reports from the military in the 1950s, 60s, and I think 70s of UFOs hovering over nuclear missile silos. You know, and certainly if you were an advanced race scouring the cosmos for life, one sure bet to find it would be to look for nuclear events that aren't happening on stars, to look for them outside of that area, because those events don't just happen every day by accident. So, but in terms of UFO phenomena, it's been around for so long, and I can't help but ask myself, it's been 60 years now or longer. When are we going to get some definitive answers? And I guess the next question I ask myself is there something that we could do? One thing that I've wondered is whether or not some enterprising company might be able to sell kind of a UFO detector, something that would just, who knows, pick up something in a mile or two range. You could stick an antenna on your roof, and if it detects something that's not supposed to be there, it might send out a little message. Now, one of these things wouldn't do a whole lot, but if you were able to sell this as a kit and get, children and interested adults all over the country to put them up, you could use something like the Internet to track these sightings pretty well. You could probably actually pull together more information than the government could on a good day. So,
well, yeah, the Internet has provided a role of gathering these kinds of stories and information, and that's one of the reasons why we know the sightings are so extant. I mean, my wife saw one when she was a kid, and it freaked her out so much. It was just about 300 feet outside the window, and it was at night, scared her so bad she wouldn't sleep alone in her bedroom for a year. Her mom, my mother-in-law has seen them on a number of occasions. One time there was, you know, floating out there for about 2 hours. She was going and getting her friend. And, you know, so this is not something that a friend of a friend of a friend type of thing. I personally have never seen something that was definitively a UFO type of craft. But certainly a lot of my acquaintances have. And so I don't have to go very far to find testimonials, so to speak, that are credible in my opinion. And there are millions of them out there. It's not just one or two here and there with a, you know, some doctored up photo.
Sure, and I think that people's take on it really depends on where they live and what they're used to also. I lived in the Redmond area for over a decade, you know, and Redmond is near, I'd say it's close to Boeing Field, close to SeaTac. You know, it's in several major flight paths. And so, you know, we were used to seeing strange things in the sky all the time, and we just didn't pay much attention to it. But you go out to a more rural area, like the area where I grew up, there was one flight path, and we knew everything that was on it, you know, where it was coming from, where it was going, and anything else was something that, you know, arose suspicion. So I think that people, you know, their perspective depends on what they're used to, and with UFOs, certainly that's the case. I think that we should give people more credit than we have in the past because, you know, people are used to their environment. They're used to what they see. When they see things that are out of the ordinary, I think those are reports that are valuable and we should be collating that data.
Yeah. Well, the ones that are supposed to be correlating it are sweeping it under the carpet and saying it doesn't exist.
Yeah. Well, and there's really no excuse today. Again, because of the Internet, organizing and processing all these sightings should be a piece of cake for something as vast as our government.
Mm-hmm. When we come back from the break, let's talk about the work of Stephen Greer. I'm sure you've followed that and the Disclosure Project and other anti-gravity effects that are actually being developed by mankind and published.
Will you be ready when gas prices go back up? Convert your vehicle to a hydrogen boost hybrid. Get 15 to 25% improved gas mileage guaranteed or your money back. And cleaner emissions. Hydrogen Boost has 8 years of experience in hydrogen injection and mileage enhancement and a money back satisfaction guarantee. Visit www.hydrogen-boost.com or call 518-480-4026. Hydrogen Boost, 518-480-4026 or visit hydrogen-boost.com.
Free energy, now!
Sterling Allen here, coming back at you from Eagle Mountain. We're talking tonight with Tim Ventura. I heard when I mentioned earlier that he's from Canada. Actually, he's 500 feet away from Canada. He's in Washington. So, Tim, let's pick up where we left off in talking about anti-gravity and where it is today. And not, we were talking in the last segment kind of about, you know, extraterrestrial UFOs and things like that. Let's get back, you know, on the ground here, what is real and recognized in society today, and maybe even on the fringe a little bit in terms of, you know, what's going on in anti-gravity research.
Well, I think one of the most exciting contemporary researchers, definitely recognized by the accredited scientific community, is Dr. Martin Kaggmar. And that's spelled, obviously his first name is Martin, last name is T-A-J-M-A-R. Different people pronounce it different ways. Some people say Tagmar, others say Kaggmar. But, he is an Austrian researcher working at one of the big government labs. Working, of course, with big government money, lots of great researchers around him, and they are doing very, very rigorous work that I believe is at least partially government funded. Essentially, they're using rotating superconductors, which most people may remember from the 90s. There was a fellow named Dr. Evgeny Podkletnov, who was a Russian scientist working in Finland, and he had claimed that rotating superconductor created a essentially a column of reduced gravity that smoke from a researcher's pipe seems to fill and then travel up. Now, Pogletnov said at the time that they had gotten, I believe it was only a few percent reduction in gravity by doing this, but they ran up two different floors above the same spot and noticed that this beam went up to the sky, as it were. So everything above this was being blocked, and so they called it basically a gravitational shield. Well, there was a lot of debate about that and several replication attempts. And, again, it's one of those areas where there's so much back and forth, it's difficult to know how real it actually is. The problem was the Russians are just plain ahead of us in terms of superconductor technology, or they were back then. And so everyone who tried to replicate this experiment in the States was working with inferior products of a much smaller size. So Pogletnov just lucked out by virtue of working with the kind of tools that he would need to see this type of effect. So that's part of it. But what makes Timar special is that he's able to draw from all these past experiments and see the kinds of failures they've had in the past and eliminate this from his own work. Now, they were using, I believe it's called the laser gyroscope. And again, it's been a couple of years since I've spoken with them, but even back in 2006, laser gyroscope, laser gyrometer, one of the two. And it's a little bit like a timing light on an engine, where basically the engine has a rotating wheel and you have a light that flashes at a certain point, and if everything matches up correctly, the light will flash over a chalk mark on the wheel and it'll let you know that everything is timed correctly. Well, they use something a little bit similar for this superconductor, and it's a laser-based system that can basically detect deviations in gravity. And what they found was a very, 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 very minor deviation in gravity. That's basically, you could call it a warping in time-space. And it's so slight that you would never detect it. It's a millionth of a millionth of anything that is measurable, normally. But at the same time, Timar noted that this anomaly is several million times greater than Einstein's predictions from relativity theory. So they're seeing a real effect, and they've replicated this 300-something times. And one of the reasons they did so many replications was they really didn't want to ruin their scientific reputations by making statements that they couldn't back up. So he's definitely one of the key figures to watch.
What about on the fringe? Let's talk about John Hutchinson.
Well, I'm a big fan of Hutchinson. The problem with Hutchinson, I think, is there are a lot of people out there who have difficulty believing that these things could happen. But essentially, Hutchinson uses a combination of electrostatic, electromagnetic field generators. Some of these are RF transceivers that he scavenged from old Canadian Navy ships, the scrapyard. He combines this with Tesla coils, frequency generators, all sorts of things. And he basically plays around with these things and sees effects that are suspiciously similar to what was reported with the Nazi Bell as well as the Philadelphia experiment. He sees metals melting together at room temperature, different materials like wood embedding itself into metal at room temperature. These things will turn into a liquid or a putty and vibrate and then become solid again. He sees things lift up and spontaneously fly all over the place. Those are a couple of many, many effects. And what makes Hutchinson very, very interesting is that many of these effects have been caught on film. The difficulty is replicating it. He really does it by feel, and a lot of people are just kind of suspicious because, one of the hallmarks of science is being able to understand it well enough that somebody else can replicate it. And in this case, he will just kind of start twisting dials and turning knobs, and, these effects start to happen. But I would say that it is replicable in terms of, people bring cameras, they get stuff on film all the time.
Yeah, there's an associate, Tim Cullen, who stopped by there on his way down. He hung out with us for a while, Tim Cullen did, and he got some stuff on film, saw a lot of stuff, you know, water levitating out of a glass up several feet, just really, really strange stuff.
You know, it doesn't surprise me in the slightest. There was a period of time, I believe it was 10 to 12 years, where Hutchison didn't have all the right equipment, and so he wasn't able to replicate this effect. And that just gave critics all the fodder they needed. They really cut him to pieces. And then sure enough, around, I think it was around 2006, early 2007, he was able to get some of the equipment together again, some of these old high-output transceivers, and he started creating these effects again. It's been probably about a year since I've really talked to him. I would imagine, though, that he's got even more since then.
Actually, his stuff is for sale, it was anyway, on eBay for $2 million.
Oh, I didn't realize that.
Yeah, he's putting it all up. I think he's just kind of burned out, fed up.
Well, you know, one of the challenges with this area for all of us is that burnout factor. It's difficult because a lot of people in the public will look at it and giggle, but you know, at the same time, they did that for Da Vinci, right? He designed the helicopter 500 years before it became a reality. So.
Mm-hmm. How much did you ever stop in on Hutchison? Did you ever see his setup in person?
I did. Now, when I was there, he didn't have all the equipment. But what I was able to do is go through boxes and boxes of metal samples, and I got lots and lots of close-up photos. And again, this is stuff that I'm going to be putting up, some of it for the first time, because I have a lot that never made it online, at AmericanAntiGravity.com. And I was absolutely convinced from looking into metal samples that these weren't faked, they weren't props. He would have an aluminum ingot, right? Just, you know, regular, honest-to-goodness piece of aluminum with a piece of wood embedded in it. The wood wasn't burned or scorched in the slightest. And I just can't imagine how you would get something like that normally. So I think that Hutchison is the real deal. It's just difficult to predict what will happen and when.
Yeah, the unworst enemy phenomenon lives pretty well up in his apartment.
Yeah. Well, you know, Hutchison is, in a strange sense, you know, he has run-ins with the Canadian EPA and stuff occasionally. And it's almost a travesty because he really is kind of a Canadian legend. And I think that his memory will long outlast a lot of contemporary things in that area. So I would hope that BC would, you know, at some point wise up and realize what a true gem they have in their area.
Yeah, he really needs to have a whole lab and support staff and all kinds of stuff.
Hutchison, I guess you could almost call what he's working with almost seems like a Pandora's box. But, you know, it goes back to one of the things that John Daring had said to me in the Philadelphia experiment story, which is, you know, playing with gravity, playing with unified field effects is like grabbing the cat's tail. You don't just get the tail, you get the whole cat. And one of Daring's theories about the Philadelphia experiment was that it was a horrific disaster, that it worked too well and destroyed the minds of sailors and caused all sorts of damage in the process. So he believed that the Philadelphia experiment was covered up because it worked so well that then basically it scared the Navy to death.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's something that they couldn't control or quantize or it's like kids playing in the gun closet.
Exactly, and something goes off, it makes a loud noise, and, you know, the next thing you hear are footsteps, you know, going in the opposite direction as fast as they can. I think that probably describes the Philadelphia experiment.
Yeah. Well, what's your next step with American Anti-Gravity?
Well, I'm looking at different ways to structure the site right now. I was putting things up on a story-by-story basis, but I just have so many photos and video. I have thousands of photos, nearly 100 hours of video. A lot of the video is still listed online through Google Video and YouTube and things like that. So the video is still, for the most part, up there. If you do a Google Video search for American Anti-Gravity, it should bring some back. But the idea is to build something that becomes what it was originally intended to be, which is a community resource, to try and bring together, I guess, diverse interests and diverse trains of thought on a singular focus, which really is, you know, the future of space propulsion.
Yeah. Well, Tim, we appreciate you joining us on the show tonight. You can find us at the website, AmericanAntiGravity.com, and archive.org. We'll have previous versions of that, and it's all over the web. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks again.
You've been listening to Free Energy Now, brought to you by PES, Pure Energy Systems. You may access past archives and upcoming show info at freeenergynow.net and join us for our daily news at freeenergynews.com. We invite you to see our directory of energy technologies at peswiki.com. That's peswiki.com. PES, the Pure Energy Systems Information Network.